Now, welcome to another inspiring edition of Sound Insight with Dr. Tom Curran.
Good morning. Welcome to Sound Insight. This is Tom Curran. It's a Sacred Heart Radio Book Club edition of the program, and I'm joined today by Father Kurt Nagel and Father Jeff Lewis. Today, we are discussing for the second time the book by Father Robert Spitzer, Christ versus Satan in Our Daily Lives, The Cosmic Struggle Between Good and Evil, published by Ignatius Press. Hello, Father Lewis and Father Nagel.
Hello, Tom.
Good morning.
Well, today we're going to dive right in. We're going to go to our break, and then when we come back, we'll introduce the book briefly by Father Robert Spitzer, Christ versus Satan in Our Daily Lives, and we are going to dive in, beginning with Chapter 4. Back in a minute with Sound Insight. Hey, this is Dr. Tom Curran, the host of Sound Insight, but also a realtor serving wonderful folks like you in the state of Washington and in Idaho. I've had the privilege and pleasure of helping dozens of families in the last 2.5 years discern and find a strategy, a path, and a plan to help their families find a whole new life in eastern Washington and northern Idaho. If I could be of service to you in that, I would love to. Please reach out, drtomcurran.com, drtomcurran.com. Welcome back to the program. This is Tom Curran. Father Nagel is going to lead us off with a scripture and a prayer.
I'd like to start with a reading from Mark 1, verses 9 through 13. It happened in those days that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized in the Jordan by John. On coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens being torn open and the Spirit, like a dove, descending upon him. And a voice came from the heavens, "You are my beloved Son, with you I am well pleased." At once the Spirit drove him into the desert, and he remained in the desert for 40 days, tempted by Satan. He was among the wild beasts, and the angels ministered to him. Almighty God, in our own journey through this world, this life, from our baptism to heaven, we are also tempted oftentimes in the wilderness. I ask your blessings upon all who are speaking on this program, but also listening in, that we might gain knowledge and grace from Father Spitzer's insights and just also from the way in which you want to work through this program, that we might continue this journey towards you well and courageously, worthily, humbly. Let us resist the temptations of the evil one. And again, bless and anoint this hour, we ask through Christ our Lord. In the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Father Nagel. All right, I've been given the task to just give a brief overview of this book, Christ versus Satan in Our Daily Lives, The Cosmic Struggle Between Good and Evil by Father Robert Spitzer. If you had a chance to listen to the first part, we had a chance to sort of introduce the book. Father Lewis gave kind of a thorough overview of how this book is the first of a trilogy of books. The first two have been published, and it follows from and can be traced back or rooted in a quartet of books that Father Spitzer has already published, which focused more on the rational side, the reason-pursuing side of our faith and in flourishing as a human being. This particular book he wrote at a moment during he discerned it during a moment of COVID, where he saw so many things happening that just seemed to be sort of out of control. And it's like, what is going on here? And he saw the hand of the demonic. He saw the hand of Satan at work. And he felt through that a prompting to write this, not an article, not a blog post, but just crank out three volumes, each of which is over six, this one's over 400 pages long.
Typical response of Father Spitzer. God bless him.
God bless him is right.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that we appreciated from the previous conversation was that he expands the, not genre, but he expands the breadth of topics that I'm typically associating with Father Spitzer, more philosophical, scientific, rational, rooted in life principles and healing the culture, those sorts of themes. This carries him into a realm that was surprising but incredibly informative. That's how I would put it. Father Lewis, how about you?
I agree. It seems and not just informative, but as he's progressing through his own life and spirituality and spiritual growth, his writings seem to, at least so far, reflect that, because, you know, intellectual conversion is where conversion most often begins, right? And then spiritual conversion would follow. So I understand your point. I think that God exists. Now we start to take that in and we start to believe it. And then that bears fruit in terms of the change of life that we have, some of the moral conversion. So not that Father Spitzer needs these conversions, but he's progressing deeper, I think, in his own relationship and discipleship with Christ. And his writings, I think, are reflecting that. And the progression of them reflects that.
Yeah, Father Nagel.
For me personally, it was sort of intellectual conversion was first. I'm not sure that's always the case. I think for some people it's not. I think it's a heart matter. It's a emotional matter that they eventually then learn about the God they have discovered. But either way, I do think that this is Father Spitzer's way. So again, it goes back to the autobiographical richness of the entire work, I think, for me. I see Spitzer, even in the order of these things, there's intellectual rationale for it, but it's also his story, and I think that's one of the reasons this is very much, it's probably maybe too strong, but a confession. The autobiography is told in terms of this sort of spiritual multi-volume work, and it's not technically, but he does share so much about himself, and I think probably unconsciously or consciously, that the structure of this also mirrors probably some of his own experience and his own journey to the Lord.
So interesting. I was going to say that in this second part, we're looking at part 2, chapters 4 through 6, and there are some appendices at the end that we're not going to cover today. And in fact, we're not even confident we'll get through chapter 4, to be honest with you. It's so rich. Chapters 5 and 6 talk about the deadly sins and does so with tremendous insight. But chapter 4 is entitled How the Devil Works. And I got to tell you, just again, that chapter all by itself was like a manual. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like a manual. And when I say that, I mean that not just like in the popular sense, but after the Council of Trent, it became popular to teach themes of theology in manuals.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't know, fathers, if you ever did this, but I would kind of dig into some of the like moral manuals and the manuals around spiritual and ascetical and mystical theology. And that manual form I found like super helpful, because it kind of map it all out. Like you go from here and here's this stage and here's what it looks like and here are the things that you do about it and then here's the next one. And he does that more in this chapter, and actually this whole section, but really in chapter 4, he spends a lot of time like linking and drawing lines. It's like you need a map. You need a map. This I talk about in book 1, chapter 3, section 2 of the quartet. And this reflects on all that. Yes. Remember all that stuff I did around the four levels of happiness? This actually maps out against that. And here's how. In part 1, I mean, just to say, like, and I'll dive in right here as we get started. In chapter 4, How the Devil Works, he says in number 1, spiritual maturity, cosmic struggle, and the Lord's loving perspective. He says, for those seeking a way to ultimate happiness and a way out of cosmic emptiness, alienation, loneliness, and darkness, there comes a time, blah, blah, blah. He means something very concrete, very specific, and he intentionally uses the words cosmic emptiness distinct from but related to alienation, which is distinct from and related to loneliness, which is distinct from and related to darkness. And that's something that I would say most readers who are picking up spiritual books, when you see lines of like nouns like that, they don't mean that degree of precision and have specific content and experiences associated with them. Anybody who appreciates order, organization, and a systematized approach to unfolding content, this book does it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Spitzer does that a lot in not just this book, but other books. You know, the unaccustomed reader could look at these lists of nouns that he puts together and things, you know, I think sometimes like this seems arbitrary. This seems like it's filler, but he goes on to explain and connect those things. You're right. It's extremely systematic, but not in a way that's bulky or unattractive in its reading. It doesn't It doesn't bog down the
Actually,
the,
for some, it does, because Carrie and I have been arm wrestling over this book, and Carrie's like, flip, flip, flip. Okay.
Oh.
So there are certain ways that he goes about explaining things that are attractive to maybe you, Father, who are maybe more logically oriented and systematized. Not for Carrie.
They can slow things down for others. Yeah.
You know, I was
I'm sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead, Father Nagel.
Maybe I cut you off, so...
Go for it.
Okay, so it goes back to, Tom, defense and praise of the manual tradition, which has a bad rap, right? When I was in the seminary, at least, the professors there would talk in the works that were given to us. There was this boogeyman from the past, was the manual tradition, where we got in post-Vatican II, we got away from that, where you just sit down there and have these, you know, this schema of sin and what you're supposed to do about it, et cetera, that was seen as lifeless and dry and divorced from the real world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that just as your description of your wife, Carrie, and there's some truth to that, in the sense of it probably could be eventually lists and these ordered things, and but there's something lost too if we don't have that kind of order in our understanding of the devil's working and the way of grace. So it's just interesting. I think there's something that there, Tom, that you were harking back to that was valuable. And was life-giving at one time. Of course, everything can kind of go into a decadent phase, perhaps. I don't know. But it's something to think about, just in terms of there's different approaches, different needs. And I think Spitzer does a pretty good job of enlightening sort of the manual or the systematized structure of presenting moral theology and spirituality. So I just find it interesting when the whole idea of the manual tradition. Anyway, throw that out there.
Yeah, no, I think that... folks today who are looking for clarity really benefit from that,
right?
Clarity. And that towards that end of the autobiographical approach, as it's mapped out in the book too, I hadn't thought of it till just now. I focused on that connection to the manuals, but I think of John of the Cross and the Ascent of Mount Carmel or the Dark Knight, and it's in a more narrow focused way. His writings are kind of, an autobiographical mapping out of the journey that everyone takes. But he can only do that because he has made the journey. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that in some ways you're right, that he is doing this. Just a general question before we go forward. He uses literary references a lot,
yeah.
A surprising amount, mm-hmm. right? And I'm familiar with his other writings, and I'm used to him quoting like scientists and philosophers and occasionally like current cultural references. But this book in particular, in chapter 4, well, no, he also does it in chapters 5 and 6,
yeah,
when he kind of identifies an example of the deadly sins. He uses extended literary references. Did you find that compelling? Did you find that helpful and interesting?
I found it compelling. In fact, he goes out of his way. He'll say, now let's take a look at how this plays out in literature. He'll say that in like phrases. But I think that's good, because you know there's something about classic literature that, in the telling of those stories, there is much about the characters in the story as the stories themselves, and in good literature have a way of portraying humanity as humanity really is, in all of its ugliness and brokenness, but also in all of its beauty and glory. And so it makes sense to reference that, because they can be things that we can all, maybe we're familiar with or we have access to. So it's not someone's private life, but someone who has observed humanity and put it in a public form that we can all observe, and so we can glean lessons from that. But yeah, I think it's a good tactic.
I agree. I thought it's very valuable, and we all love stories. We're all about stories, and so again, the characters that we love, the books we've read, the plots that we have been absorbed in, the idea that being able to show the way in which God and grace are at work in those. As preachers or as speakers, the people are captured by stories. They're going to listen to you. As long as you tell them the story, for the most part, the boring clock stops. You know, you only have so much time to listen for people before they tune out on you. But if you're telling a story, the stop clock, the clock stops for that, and then it'll start it up when you start to make your point. But I think he's a really wise man to do that.
You know, it's interesting. I'm kind of going to fade off for a little moment here. My philosophy professor and eventually spiritual director in the seminary, an incredible holy priest of God, he talked about the importance of connecting truth and meaning, the entailments of truth. And if you can find meaningful ways to connect that which is true in terms of how it has necessary implications for life, and you can find experiences in life that they connect to, then you will help truth go from something that's more abstract to something that's relatable and accessible and able to be appropriated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just said something very philosophical there.
Yeah.
But here it is. You tell a story, people get it.
Yeah.
Right? There you go. Right. So, but I took that to heart. I took that to heart, and I always take that to heart by trying to link the most profound truths through analogy to meaningful human experiences and stories. And so I can see that. I was thinking more of David Tracy and Bernard Lonergan, right? So two kind of major theologians from the last quarter of the last century, both who focused on and drew attention to the importance of great works, right? The great works of humanity have this sort of soft glow of God's glory. And there's a way in which there's a radiance to the greatest works of art, the greatest expressions of humanity, because they're created by God, will be a link to authentic insights into God, into humanity, and into the relationship between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think this probably somewhat is linked to that. Okay. Well, diving then into chapter 4, I already started, and I haven't even gotten past the first paragraph of chapter 4 here. Father Lewis, we'll give you the privilege of anything in the first section. And if you skip beyond two more pages, you obviously haven't been paying attention to what was in here. So is there anything that you want to draw attention to?
Well, we had just been talking about his reference to literature to make a point, and just a couple pages in on our page 190, he makes his point and he begins, in his Lord of the Rings, J.R. Tolkien portrays this figuratively and accurately in the ring that Frodo, a seemingly insignificant little creature hobbit, carries around his neck. He's talking about the point that he had made, is the tools of the evil one. We move onto a path of spiritual moral conversion. We present a much greater potential to help the Lord, a much greater threat to the evil one. And anyway, so he's connecting as Frodo is getting closer, if you know the story, he gets closer to the ring's destruction, it starts to have more power on him. He's more of a threat. He's cooperating more with kind of the blessings and the nature of the good, and therefore evil is ramping it up. And this connects with a lesson that I learned in seminary here at Bishop White, when our current vicar general, he was our vocation right there at the time, he would tell us, the closer you get, helping us in our discernment, the closer you get to aligning your will to the will of God, to obeying and fulfilling the will of God for your life, the more intense and frequent the devil's attacks on you. And I thought that was a great lesson. It helped me to be just kind of aware of what's going on. And this feels like an attack. I must be doing something right here. And anyway, so he links that to using the use of literature and story to emphasize and illustrate that point.
Yeah.
Well, and we're up against a break here. When we come back, Father Nagel, I'm going to build off of the point that you said. I'm going to actually read the next very short paragraph that makes that link between the Frodo story and his point. And Father Nagel, you can begin with a reflection on that in just a minute on Sound Insight. Hi, this is Dr. Tom Curran, and you know me as the host of Sound Insight. I am also letting folks know that as a realtor licensed in the state of Washington and in Idaho, I love serving Catholic families and others who are discerning a move for yourselves. It's much more than buying or selling a home. It's discerning a whole new life. If that's something that you would find a help in, if I could be of service to you, please be in touch. You can find out more at drtomcurran.com, drtomcurran.com. Welcome back. This is Tom Curran, and today in the Sacred Heart Radio Book Club edition of the program, I'm with Father Jeff Lewis and Father Kurt Nagel, and we're discussing the book Christ versus Satan in Our Daily Lives, The Cosmic Struggle Between Good and Evil. And today in Chapter 4, we're taking a look at this cosmic struggle actually plays itself out in our daily lives. Yes, the demonic has you in its target, in its crosshairs. The devil's coming after you. Not behind every tree, But there is a devil at work, especially as you, Father Lewis, were making just before. The more that we make intentional, serious efforts to pursue the Lord and to honor him in all things, the more serious will be the attention of the demonic to come against us and attempt to overthrow us. The second paragraph of page 191 says this: even though God is sometimes difficult to detect on our spiritual journey, we can know him by his effects, inspiration beyond our capacity, guidance and protection beyond natural coincidence, revealing his unseen providence, and ever-increasing strength and wisdom in the spiritual and moral life through perseverance and resilience. Here's my question, Father Nagel, as we just looked at this. Oftentimes, one of the things that becomes so meaningful to people who come alive in faith is the reality that their life isn't an accident, mm-hmm. but that the Lord has a purpose and plan for their lives. Do you find that to be true, Father Nagel?
Oh, I think so. Oh, definitely. I think it's one of the great afflictions of our age is meaninglessness. I think it's always a human condition, but I think it's ramped up in our own time. I think that the question of, is everything dissolving into nothingness in my life, including that? And so I do think the challenge in that paragraph and what it describes as how to detect God in our lives, once we know that God is, once we're convicted that God is working in our lives, things do change, because then we're part of a story again, and there's meaning, there's outside of ourselves, and that's the important thing. But I think that we're so used to assuming that the meaning comes from emotion and feeling, that these sort of things, we have to step back and kind of change our lens a little bit. The idea inspiration beyond our capacity, or sort of protection beyond natural coincidence, those are insights that have to be grasped. And it can happen, certainly we do, but it's not something like the feeling or the prayer. It's not something that happens in a prayer time when suddenly we have a warm, fuzzy experience. It's an insight, it's a recognition of the way things are, that it's a different look. It's a kaleidoscope has to shift a little bit, and the little colored glass has to shift in such a way to say, so that's happening, or that's why that is. Or I can persevere. Oh, I am still doing it. And so again, I think there's a little bit of a challenge there for our people. But once we do shift that and we recognize, oh, wait a minute, something's happening here, that even in dry times that can still be true in terms of our prayer experience. So I think that that's the dynamic that I see in people that I do spiritual direction for or preach with.
So in this book, in this chapter, there's this like sort of set of three ways, sort of the three kind of principal ways that the devil, in his manual, attempts to overthrow us, get us off that path, and it's temptation, it's deception, and it's discouragement or desolation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys know, you probably noticed that, because he continues to like take those three in the thread. And I got to be honest with you, I hadn't read it so clearly before. Right. If someone said to me, what are the ways that the devil tries to throw an obstacle and trip you up? How does he try to be a stumbling block to your life of faith? I wouldn't have just simply said, well, of course, it's through temptation, deception, the father of lies, and through discouragement or desolation, making you feel, and he gets into this, making you feel, he uses it, criticism, exhaustion, confusion, and suffering, and how we have to push through and persevere. Did you notice that, Father Lewis?
I hadn't, but what's interesting is, some of those same words and terminology. I gave a series of faith formation presentations to my parishioners before COVID. It was a year and a half ago, on prayer, and then one of those presentations was on the difficulties in prayer. And It's interesting, this some of the same tools that the devil uses to attack us were some of the same challenges that I've identified in prayer, right down to the terminology, discouragement,
feeling overwhelmed, feeling unworthy,
right? And well, and distractions even, which if we constantly distract, we can despair. And so if we recognize that we have difficulties being able to pray, that may or may not be a direct attacked by Satan, but certainly he is pleased by that, because why? It's keeping us yet another way of keeping us from God. So I'm not surprised that he identified this. I'd not make that connection, but it's interesting that they overlap. If any difficulties we might have in prayer, that overlaps with that.
Father Nagel.
Well, I hadn't noticed it the same way you did, Tom. But you mentioned the word distraction. That would be one thing on I would have added here, too, if I was going to talk about the way the devil works on us. I was kind of wondering, okay, because he does get here to it sometimes, but he doesn't make it so explicit in terms of the distracting or the hypnotizing or just putting you to sleep. Or rather than the act of discouragement or the temptation just to kind of let's pretend I'm not here. It's not that he doesn't deal with this, but I would have added that deception, discouragement, discernment, and distraction. But I think that's why this chapter 4 is so powerful, is it does lay out the game plan of Satan.
It is. It's so fascinating. If we have time to get into it, I found it interesting how he talked about the devil attacks us through the flesh indirectly. And then he kind of shunted off into sort of the end of the chapter, the way that the devil uses culture. Because I was more accustomed to the world of flesh and the devil. Right. And I thought that those three would be covered together. But he never went there. Mm. He always talked about the flesh, and that's how I'm calling it. He talks about egocentricity, like level one. Mm. But the flesh and the devil as sort of direct means of attack in attempt to undermine our faith. And then how culture is also used, and he uses that word culture. So that's kind of a tangential, out on the fringe conversation. Father Nagel, I want to go back to section 2 here, two common defenses against evil. And I found this fascinating. Page 196, the third paragraph, second full paragraph. He says, before addressing specific dimensions of temptation, deceit, and despair, there's those three, we should make one important observation, namely that evil spirits have a much easier task of realizing their dark objectives if they can undermine two common defenses in any of their victims, that is, membership in a church and openness to the full range of rational evidence for a supreme being and human transcendence. Did you happen to catch that point, Father Nagel? What do you think about that?
That was the one that jumped out at me first, though, was the being involvement in a church. Because I think our society falls headlong into this problem, because I think that our gut instinct as 21st century Western people is that the whole spiritual but not religious. The idea that the institutional church is the problem, and we mostly see the bad side, and there's bad sides. I mean, look at the world today and look at the church today. There are problems. But I just thought it was very fascinating. A defense of being a member of a church to defeat Satan, just the idea that there's defenses here. There's the idea of magisterial teaching, sacramental life, the idea of having to be with other people and all that can entail, that the devil doesn't like that. He wants a temptee that's on his or her own. So I thought that was so timely, because I think people are questioning what's the church? What good does it do? We hear so much negative ideas about it, but that's where the devil wants us to go. Go ahead and leave the church.
Listen to what he says. Listen to what he says at Topos 171 and a little bit further down. These individuals, these churchless ones, are virtually powerless to counter the suggestions of evil spirits on a conscious or discursive level, and they are left with only a vague sense of conscience to counter the suggestions of the enemy. Left to their own devices, they can be persuaded to deny their entire spiritual nature, to be led to the extremes of hedonism and egocentricity, to pursue monetary gain and economic power exclusively, and to pursue political power and status. And he goes on, and then he says this, for evil spirits, this produces a double benefit. The emptiness and despair of the churchless temptee, as well as the misery and oppression of the people around him. Hear that again. Father Lewis, you're nodding your head. You say, people, you're not going to church? Like, what's your condition? Here it is. The emptiness and despair of the churchless temptee, as well as the misery and oppression of the people around him. Do you think people get that?
I don't think people get that. I think a lot of folks, if they're not already believers, might read that and probably poo-poo it. But all the more reason why I not just appreciate Father Spitzer going right to it, but I love it. And he lists it first. Membership in a church is a defense against Satan's attacks. And he doesn't try to soften it by saying membership in a group that will build you up or anything psychological like that. He says membership in a church. And I almost wish they would have said membership in the church. And,
no,
but then,
well, he does.
I know, he does. In the very next paragraph, involvement in a church, particularly a Christian church, with the teachings of Jesus, and more particularly in the Catholic Church, with its sacramental life and magisterial teaching. So he begins that, but goes right to it. And he doesn't say, again, it's because of the community. He says it's because of what Jesus is doing through prayer, through scripture, through sacrament, through the teachings of the church. And those are what arm us in defense against the devil's attacks. And I love that he just goes right to it and says it.
And it's like, you think about deception, like the devil's deception at work in our culture today. I would say in our society, right? For me, culture is just, it's that spirit that is present in among people, that the bulwark, the strength to battle against that is a culture of faith. It's a culture of, through my participation in the body of Christ in this Catholic community, I access Jesus sacramentally, especially in the Eucharist, in confession, and then with the other believers, we are going to live a culture of radiant evangelization and speak the truth of the gospel to the world, right? Mm-hmm. That, like, that's what the church offers, mm-hmm. among other things, right? That's what the church is offering. And somehow, why do we lack conviction to talk about that? Why are we slow, and why do we hesitate to present that to people who are choosing nuns, right? They're nones. They're nuns, and just have no sense of conviction about going to a church, going to the Catholic Church, going to Mass, getting reconnected to their community of faith. Father Nagel, any insight?
Well, I think the devil's on a winning streak. I mean, if that's his strategy, it seems to be working pretty well. So I think they just recognize that what I said just a few minutes ago, I think is true, that there's a poisoning of the idea that, well, you can say that, but you haven't proven it with who you are. And so I think that although that's all true, what Spitzer says, I think sometimes it doesn't get past. Well, first off, there's other issues as well. But the idea that, are those benefits really there for me? I think they were kind of far away from those benefits even being seen as benefits by people, that they're not even looking for those goods usually. And so I think that's one of the temptations to say, oh, this is going to provide you with all these sort of things that they're looking for. They're thinking, well, will it bring me community? Will it make me feel good? But I don't mean that. Will it make me, will it bring me peace? I mean, those are the kind of conceptions that they're looking for in the church. And this is a different order of it's a supernatural order of goods that I think most people aren't even asking the questions or looking for those things.
You know, you're right. In fact, he gets at that in page 198, and when he shifts from the presentation about the church as the first defense and moves to reason,
right,
as the second. And this is what he says. And Father Nagel, you respond back here. He says, if we try to persuade this convinced temptee that he's teetering on the brink of meaninglessness and despair because of false assumptions about his nature and freedom by presenting a few sage passages from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics or a few passages from the New Testament, he's likely to produce either a confused look or more probably a defensive reaction. How dare you suggest that my life is somehow superficial, unreflective, self-limiting, and oppressive to others? You're just jealous of my successes. Who cares about those ancient Greek philosophers anyway? They didn't even have the internet, much less the latest apps.
I think right there, behind all that, that reaction, which probably is a true reaction, is the idea of what others would call expressive individualism. The default ideology or metaphysics is, I am my own person, and you have no stance by which you can judge me on these sort of issues. So that's where this, how dare you, suggests that my life is somehow superficial, unreflective, self-limiting, etc., because it's mine and I'm the sovereign of it, and therefore it must be fine. Because if I've chosen this, then I'm fulfilling my purpose. I'm doing who I'm being who I'm supposed to be. And this idea that somehow that there's fault here, or that I'm missing the mark somehow, or I'm not achieving my end, it doesn't really register for them very well. So again, I think the whole metaphysics of the modern society is sort of stacked against us in some ways to break through to the reality that they're still miserable and they are superficial. And I say we, I'm not pointing out to anybody in particular. But I think that very paragraph, he's obviously in touch with the real world, somebody who's speaking with people out in the real world. But it is a reaction.
So we're up against a break. When we come back, I'm going to read that next short paragraph, and I'll go to you, Father Lewis, because I want to ask a question about his approach, because I found it surprising. I wouldn't have gone there. That wouldn't have been the approach I would have taken to say, this is how you break through. So I'll read his, I'll mention mine briefly, and then you can say who's right. You better be me. Okay. So, all right, we're up against a break. Back in a minute with more Sound Insight. Welcome back to the program. This is Tom Kernan with Father Kurt Nagle, Father Jeff Lewis. We're reading the book, discussing it for the second time. This is part two, Christ versus Satan in Our Daily Lives by Father Robert Spitzer. And I think my discernment is clear. I'm not deceived or discouraged, but we will not get through chapter four today. And that's in part two, which is okay, because we discussed this as a possibility at the beginning, so, or before we came on. So here we go. So Father Lewis, Father Spitzer identifies two bulwarks against the typical attacks of the enemy, how Satan is attacking us in our lives through temptation, deception, and discouragement or desolation. And he says, membership in a church, and then he uses reason, and this is what he says, if we're to penetrate this extensive, superficial, defensive bulwark, we'll have to return to fundamental principles, reason, and logic, so that we can show the preponderance of evidence in favor of a God, a transphysical soul in Jesus Christ. If we can establish the likelihood of these transcendent realities, the temptee may see his former position as superficial and self-limiting, inciting him to take the next step, the pursuit of a Christian church and a life of virtue. And I'm going to hesitantly say, I wouldn't have gone there. I would have said something more like, the radiant testimony of a life changed by someone who's welcomed Jesus Christ fully in their lives. Their brokennesses have been conquered. They're healed. They're living a life of faith and radiating joy and peace and freedom that the other one longs for and doesn't even imagine exists. So I would have gone more towards the radiant witness route. Like that's like evangelizing and preaching the gospel. So how do those two fit together? And what do you think about that?
Well, I agree with you, Tom. I think if I were to encounter a person who reacted like this in that paragraph above, the "how dare you" statement, I've been trained in seminary, and maybe it's also my personal disposition. Okay, so they're speaking from a very emotional standpoint. Let's try to find a way for heart to speak to heart. That's John Cardinal Newman's his Episcopal motto is heart speaks to heart. And, there's something about that that speaks to me. Let's try to get them, let's meet them where they are and try to bring them out of the emotive and into the intellectual. And Spitzer doesn't propose that here. He wants to go right to reason and logic. That makes sense given a system of thought, his conviction that, intellectual conversion in general comes first, moral conviction comes last, in between is the spiritual conversion. But I think the key word here for me is, if we can establish the likelihood of these transcendent realities, the temptee may see his former position as superficial and self-limiting. And I think that's prudent for him to emphasize, to have included that word may, because it may not work. At the very least, you might just be able to hope that you've planted a seed and maybe it'll give them something to chew on. And then maybe it will also result in them having a second thought or at least a new thought.
Right. It incites him to take a step, a pursuit of a church. There's a lot of conditionals in there.
Yeah. Right. So. Yeah. But I think that might connect to a point you made earlier that that Jesus emphasizes the need for perseverance. For those of us who are trying to show Christ to others and to bring Christ to others, we have to persevere, not just in our own progression in the spiritual life, but with those around us who are also hopefully on that same progression. St. Paul says as much, we got to be patient with those with the scruples of those whose faith is weak. And so we need to persevere. Okay, I think I may have planted a seed. I'm not going to just leave it there, though. Let's circle around and come back and just kind of follow up on that and to be deliberate about that. And so it can be both, I think, the heart-to-heart, because I have a loving concern for this person insofar as this is a soul that God created and God wants to be in heaven forever. And that's my heart-to-heart connection. And my route to the heart, I'm going to try and attempt through reason and logic, through the head.
You know, I agree with you, Tom, in the sense of your original insight. I think, but we're all so different. I mean, in my time as a priest, I've seen different people are reached different ways. I think that, again, Spitzer's speaking out of his own experience here and his own personality or temperament, and assuming this is this great defense. And I do think it is. It's important because I think in this time era, that it's easy to say, well, nobody's been argued into the church, et cetera. That's not completely true. But there is certainly a place to say that this is not simply, you know, a matter of pure faith. We have reasons for believing what we believe. It's rational, what we're doing. It's not, at least not opposed to reason at all. But I do think your insight is the most powerful approach to someone, especially as Father Lewis says, who's reacting out of this emotional. You have to present him with a powerful example of a human being filled with God's grace.
Yes,
that's the reality.
Well, and I think this is sort of Father Spitzer's overarching project. If you look at healing the culture, right, it's a pro-life effort that is all about getting to the groundwork, right? You got to get to the foundation. Grace builds on nature. And if nature has been fragmented and broken up, denied and doubted, but we've got to rebuild that through rational argumentation, the use of logic, getting first principles, relying on our tradition, these kinds of things. And that's reflective here, I think, in his approach. Well, I'm going to recommend that we move forward. I'm going to go to page 205 and to you, Father Nagel, skipping over that section on human freedom, which, again, is very manualistic and references the other books that he's done. The next section is on, and that's not a bad thing, folks. I'm just kind of saying it. The next section is on temptation, and I loved what he did here. In the middle of this, he has four major steps in dealing with temptation. And at the top, he mentions, where do the temptations come from ourselves or through demonic suggestion? He doesn't say the world. I'm right. Like, are you kidding? I mean, I think most temptations are coming from the world these days. But be that as it may, the flesh and the devil. When he talks about the temptation, he uses the imagination in relationship to temptation. And he basically says it this way. And Father Nagel, just again, I'd love for your reflection on this. First is an image that comes to us. Then we allow these desires that are stirred by this image. Then we entertain them. We entertain the thought, the image, and then we choose to act on it. That simple mapping out, what did you think of that?
Well, I was thinking, is this how it works? I do remember reading this and thinking, oh, first off, it's good to break it down. And this idea, this gradual going over Niagara Falls, you know, it's kind of going closer, then boom, you've made the choice. When I was reading this and thinking about it, I do think I think it's true. First off, I thought it was good in the sense of be careful about how you think and where your imagination goes. And I was also thinking, we are not very disciplined, and I'm not necessarily very disciplined in my imagination. I have a tendency to think that I don't have any control over it, and that it's not a bad thing that I don't. That this is part of my, it's a wrong part of my freedom, is that these things happen. Now, at some point, I stop it I stopped the process too late. You know, we're 10 yards from going over Niagara Falls, and I tried to start to row backwards, as opposed to where am I going from the very beginning? What is coming into my consciousness? And for me, it was like, how do I fence off way back? It talked to me about the old ideas of custody of the eyes and these sort of things of what do I read, what do I watch. So anyway, that's where I went with it. It's just that it was a nice breakdown, and it sort of revealed to me that once again the idea of disciplining my decisions and my imagination way back from the idea of choosing is important for me.
This makes me think of another book I've read by Monsignor Brian Bransfield, called The Human Person. It's kind of his take and summary relating theology of the body of JP2 to kind of the culture of the time and looking at the last 150 years of American history. And he identifies what he calls the seven stages of sin. But the moment of the sin itself is not the first step. It's halfway down. And this kind of aligns with that very closely. So they observe the same kind of thing. To be presented with something that could become a temptation and then to let it grow. We're placing ourselves in a near occasion of sin if we go that far. That itself, you know, we chalk up as a venial sin, I suppose. But the moment we actually commit the sin, you know, we can be presented with something that could tempt us. A lot of folks will agonize over, I saw this image, or I thought this thought, or I was bombarded with this temptation, and they are racked with guilt over that. And you know, if they haven't made the choice, well, we're assaulted, and you persevered, you prevailed, but the choice to sin comes down later. And like Father, like you were saying, you know, if we're going to go that far and let it get that far, how much more difficult it is to resist the decision to choose to sin? You use the analogy of Niagara Falls, and I think of, like, you know, I'm playing with a snowball at the top of a mountain. I could just put that down, or I could let it roll down the mountain, and it becomes this huge avalanche. It was much easier to stop that from happening by just putting the snowball over here and not letting it happen. And that would, you know, the moment I am presented with something that could be a temptation to dismiss it, go on to something and think of or focus on something that's pertaining to the higher desires of holiness and happiness.
You know, and I don't know if this came from a manual or from a talk about temptation. It was the insight was that the way that I was formed, you know, temptations will come to us, and we're not, you know, responsible for those. We have to be ready for them and battle against them. And then the comment was not so fast, because if you choose sin, you're actually creating the downhill trend. Right, you're increasing concupiscence, that urge towards sin. And if you fall into a habit of sin, then even those temptations that you don't consciously conjure up, they're there because you have chosen sin in the past. So you're actually creating this dynamic in you where temptations are going to arise because of the bondage to sin that exists in your life.
I think there's something to that. You know, maybe I don't have any currently, I don't have any temptations to sin by gambling away my savings, let's say, so that you can mention the word casino, or I could even drive by it and I'm just not even thinking about that. But then I go in and gamble, and maybe I develop that addiction. Now I can't even think the word casino, and like, I got the itch, I got to go, because that has developed. Yeah, I think you're right, Tom. There's definitely something to that.
Yeah, so interesting. Back in a minute with Sound Insight. All right, so here we are. We're discussing the book Christ versus Satan in our daily lives. Father Nagel, I've never given you a chance to kind of reference a section. So we're down to the three cardinal virtues. Is there anything in that section, and that begins on page 207, where he focuses in on really three cardinal virtues, prudence, temperance, and fortitude. Anything about that section that you'd like to draw attention to?
I didn't have anything really particularly marked out here. I'm trying to look here very quickly to see if...
Yeah, it's fine. I'm not trying to tempt you down a wrong path or deceive you or discourage you.
No.
I found it very fascinating the way that he focused in on how the evil one tailors temptations for each individual. I thought that was, again, a fascinating section.
Yeah.
And he talks about that on page 212 at the top. He has four identifiers of how the devil is actually specifically molding and shaping a temptation or a plan of attack for each of us. He talks about the vices that we're most attracted to, the virtues that are the weakest or least developed in us, the times and conditions in which we're most vulnerable, and the resentments we might hold toward God, the church, or any moral authority. What did you think about that?
I thought that I think it's kind of creepy in some sense, you know, in a good way, in the sense of the devil has me personally in his sights. It's not like I'm one of many and he's going to do some sort of blanket temptation out there. But it's kind of like people who steal your online information and stuff. They want to scam you. They're doing other things. They're going for other people too, these horrible, you know, black ops, I don't know what, black web, dark web, whatever it is. The people are just coming out there trying to get your stuff. But they're going after your information. And so I thought that was, I think, healthy to know, wait a minute, he's looking at me. And what are my weak spots? I better shore him up.
You know, it's so interesting, Father Lewis, when I read these four, vices, virtues, times and conditions when we're most vulnerable, and resentments, I put in like four other categories. I put in wounds, like from our past, where we're wounded. Like mm-hmm. That's a vulnerable spot. And then what about our personality? About our temperaments?
Yeah.
How about those tendencies of our personality? Aren't those like prime matter for figuring out like how to attack us? Those are things that I often think about when Kerry and I talk about the temptations that our kids are drawn to. We tend to focus a lot on those things.
Hmm. Well, I think they would still be at play here because that, maybe I have a bombastic personality that is easily wounded when my pride is wounded. Well, that's a vice, you know, and so I don't think that Father Spitzer would dismiss that. I think he would fold it in, and these are kind of higher, more general categories of the plan of attack. So that's my suspicion, because that's too readily observed in lived reality for Father Spitzer to have just dismissed it entirely, even if he doesn't explicitly discuss it. I think he would fold it in.
I think one of the distinctions here, though, is what you just described, Tom, those aren't really our fault too much. These are things that we can control in their weaknesses. The other things are vulnerabilities. Oftentimes we've been wounded, but it wasn't our fault. Our temperament and our personality, oftentimes that's what it is. They provide perhaps ends for the devil to work. But vices, resentments, virtues that are weak because we haven't worked on them, those are things that are on us, and we might have more of a tendency not to work on or not to deal with them. I think our culture tends to think in terms of vulnerabilities and wounds and temperaments as opposed to moral flaws that we have allowed the devil to have access to us because we haven't done what we're supposed to do.
Yes. No, that for sure, that makes sense. Well, and then he maps out these types of believers and plans of attack based on his four levels of happiness. He talks about these four groups, those with no religious or moral conversion, those with weak or tepid religious or moral conversion. And then he moves forward and talks about those that are striving towards strong religious and moral conversion, and then those that have strong religious and moral conversion. And he's thorough. Mm. I mean, he goes into it, and again, he does a lot of correlating between this work and the four levels of happiness and the when he connects it back to this section and that section. And he actually does a little bit of previewing here and further into the chapter into how the church's life of prayer and sacraments, that's volume two of the trilogy. Are you guys tracking me? Mm-hmm. This is like where he's anticipating that as we unfold this is also going to be related to these different levels and layers of conversion. Father Lewis, did you find those sections like interesting, helpful, or any insight in there that you want to draw attention to?
I did. I like you had mentioned, I connected these four groups with the four levels of happiness. He probably explicitly stated that somewhere.
At the very beginning of the section.
Okay. And it's interesting. If we want to progress in the more mature and deeper and longer lasting happiness, it's inalienably linked to growth in the spiritual life. We've got to see that the highest level of happiness is rooted in God alone, and that means we've got to be religious. We've got to be spiritual. We've got to work toward that. And if we have no religious or moral conversion, we're in the first group. We live in just a very superficial realm of not even maybe happiness. He calls happiness, but just I'm content for now. I've distracted myself from the gloom and doom of the inevitable decay, but and so on from there. I identified that that linking. I appreciated the connections he made.
Well, believe it or not, good fathers, we have 30 seconds left.
Whoa.
I cannot believe how quickly this time has gone by. And so, Father Nagel, you get 30 seconds, and then I'll give you 30 seconds, Father Lewis.
Oh, wow.
To just offer final comment.
Again, this chapter itself is a moral handbook and a spiritual handbook, great for spiritual directors, but also for anybody who wants to grow in the spiritual life. I'm not on Kerry's side on this particularly one, time. I'm on your side. I think this is a book that there's just deep meat here, and so I would go out and definitely get a hold of Christ vs. Satan in Our Daily Lives by Robert Spitzer. So my 30 seconds is simply a plug.
Yeah, mine would be as well. It's a plug. You know, this book is so rich, and I don't know if we'll be able to spend another five or six programs discussing it, but it would certainly warrant it. And you know, I think folks just need to read it.
And just a clarification, Carrie actually loves the book. She just skips over the literature parts of it.
Oh, she's
Like,
okay.
Yeah, she won't give it back to me because she's gone into so deeply into these seven deadly sins. She's like, I got to go to confession. So what a beautiful benefit. It's an incredible book, Christ versus Satan in Our Daily Lives by Father Robert Spitzer. Thanks so much for joining me today. Join me tomorrow for more Sound Insight.